You are listening to Episode 0 of Season 8 of the GNU World Order. Yes, it's true, GNU World Order is back. I've had about a month off, and I'm doing air quotes with off because I wasn't really that off. I was actually working really hard at some updates at the place where I work, so it's been actually a really busy month, but it's been good because I've learned quite a lot of computer-related stuff, so that gave me kind of ammunition for the upcoming season. But you know who I want to welcome back? It's you, my dear listeners. Welcome back to the show. Thank you for tuning in once again. So this episode, we're going to talk about some listener feedback. I think we'll talk a bit about setting up Fedora for public use or for serious use, let's say. We'll be talking about, lots of stuff. Let's just get started. Well, before we dive into the listener feedback, and there is a lot, so I'm not sure how much I'm going to be able to cover in this episode. Plus, I've never been very organized with listener feedback, so I've probably lost track of a lot. But before we even get into that, let's talk a little bit about GNUWorldOrder.info. Did you know that this podcast had a website? Well, if you didn't, it is at GNUWorldOrder.info, and it is totally different now. Yes, I have changed GNU World Order. For this, probably about the second time, really. This is the second major revision of it. The first one you wouldn't have... No, I guess third, really. The first you wouldn't know about because it was after the first season, and hopefully I've lost all of the people who were actually around for my shameful first season. But the about the third or fourth or fifth season-ish, Snack Machine B, a good friend of mine, came in out of nowhere and just kind of redid my entire site in HTML5 and CSS3, and taught me a whole heck of a lot about both of those two languages as a result, because I just kind of looked at his code, and his code was beautiful. I mean, when you say well-organized, well-structured code, that was the definition of what he did. It was really, really cool. Well, recently I decided to... Well, first of all, I decided to switch hosts. GNU World Order has been writing for free for about 7 seasons now. And I decided eventually lately that I guess I'm really kind of doing the whole Ogcasting thing. It probably kind of snuck up on me that the realization that I've been doing this for a very long time now. So I figured it was probably time for me to really just buckle down and take a little bit of responsibility for this stuff. So I'm actually, I did an upgrade to the server that me and Deep Geek and Lost in Bronx share, and I moved GNU World Order, and SlackerMedia.info had already been on this server, but I'm starting to consolidate a little bit, so I moved GNU World Order onto that same server, beefed up the server a little bit, and that's what you've got now. So everything has been shifted around on the back end, and since I was doing that, I figured it was probably time for sort of scaling back the website. The front page had gotten pretty busy. I mean, I have an appreciation for old-school, ugly websites. I love the accessibility of it. But now I've created a new one that is a lot more minimal, still very accessible. It's all, you know, it looks fine in links or e-links or whatever you use, w3m.el. Whatever you use for your text browsing, it looks great. I'm gonna try to figure out a way to mirror it via Gopher, but I'm not sure if that's gonna happen anytime soon. Point being, the site is looking different. It is looking good. Think it will serve us well as a very minimal front end for this show. So just be aware that yes, it has changed, and that I know that it has changed. It's an approved change. Someone has not taken over my domain or anything like that. And of course, if you look at IP addresses and things like that, then yes, the IP of GNU World Order has changed. It's on a different physical machine now, so don't let that worry you if you notice things like that. A few people have offered to mirror the site. If you want to do that, feel free to do so. That would be fine with me. And if you do that, let me know so that I can add a link to your mirror from the main website, the main page of GNU World Order. That way everyone knows that your mirror exists. So I think that's about it for the whole news about the show segment. Let's move on to listener feedback. Okay, so being off for a month kind of does let one amass a lot of email, and some of it was feedback about the show that is important. Some of it was just generic feedback. I can't stay organized with feedback. That's just not something that I apparently am all that interested in doing, because I keep saying it every season and never fix it. So, oh well. But there was some pertinent stuff, which kind of I was able to flag enough for myself to be able to find it again later, such as now. So one of the things was from a guy named Mocha, or Mr. Mocha, which, you know, you can't really go wrong when you're writing GNU World Order with the nick of Mr. Mocha. That kind of gets you flagged for review later on, you know, that's very hard to forget. So more coffee-related nicknames would help me probably organize things better. Anyway, Mocha says that he or she can't really understand anyone's desire for, these are my words, not Mocha's, but essentially what they were saying is that why would you want a USB boot stick that never remembered your changes and stuff, and wouldn't it be better to have a persistent boot USB drive that would remember and keep all of your changes and files? And of course I agree with that pretty much. I mean, yes, I think that the persistent boot Linux drive would be a lot more useful almost always. I will say that personally I have not had great luck with them. I've had kind of little bits of flaky activity, you know, with them. I mean, like, I would plug the thing in and boot off of it, and I would do some maybe configuration changes or something. It's supposed to be persistent, shut down, boot back into it later, and all the configuration changes have disappeared. Little things like that, which kind of got me less interested in booting off of a supposedly persistent boot drive on a thumb drive. So, I early on I had some not great experiences with that whole theory, and kind of thought that maybe the whole persistent boot thing was maybe a little bit of a myth. I always kind of thought, wouldn't it be interesting to have like a boot drive or a boot USB stick that had the root partition on it, and then like a separate one for your home? I don't know why that would matter, but I was thinking about that one time, because it always felt like, I guess it's that whole Squash FS thing or something, where, I mean, I don't know anything about this stuff. Point is, I became suspect about this persistent boot thing. And I'm not suspicious. But I'm not giving up on it or anything. But the real point here is that I personally don't have that much of a need for persistent boot, because all the computers, practically, that I encounter refuse to boot off of USB, or at least traditionally have refused to boot off of USB. It's built into their EFI. So USB has always kind of been great in theory and just something that would never actually work for what I do. There was one exception to that. For a while I had a job where the only computer in the room was a PC, and so it was the perfect thing for USB boot. And that kind of worked out for me, although I ended up just using disks, because really all I wanted to do was, you know, I'd boot up that disk, and then I'd just work on whatever programs was included on that live distribution, and save any important thing that I generated, any files and stuff, to a USB thumb drive that I owned, and that became my quote-unquote persistent boot. But, of course, it was never really a standardized thing. You know, I never had, oh, this is my Linux distribution with all my usual changes. I had to run everything stock. But it was good. It was interesting because I got to try lots of different portable discs, and I think I talked about a couple of them. I remember doing OpenSUSE. Wolvix was a good one. There were a couple that I tried, and I'm pretty sure I kind of reviewed on the show during that time. Now, Mocha's vote for all of this is Arch Linux. Mocha says that Arch Linux is really great for this portable, persistent Linux USB stick, that it's very lightweight and highly customizable. He says that it only takes about 55 megabytes of... I don't know if he was talking about RAM or actual disk size. It must be RAM, because he says a full X install and XFCE. I can't believe that would only be 55 megabytes. Maybe, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, he says Arch is great for that. Me, personally, I've never used Arch, really. I don't know a whole lot about it. I was going to try it on a Pogo plug that someone sent me to try out, and I got the thing I flashed the Pogo plug and got this little Arch Linux image running on it, but the minute I rebooted, the Pogo plug screwed me and just would not find the USB drive that Arch was on, and it goes into an infinite loop of searching for a drive and never finding it. It's kind of annoying. But it's actually sort of a brick, basically, is what it is. That was too bad. But, yeah, I've never really tried Arch. I know a lot of people do like it. I don't see the need for it for myself right now, because I've got Slackware, which I feel is as customizable and totally stable as I want it to be. And so I just haven't really looked into Arch. But he's saying that Arch as a persistent USB distribution works really, really well, and that everyone should try it, and that Pac-Man is better than apt. So there you go. I mean, I've always heard really great things about Arch, so I'm sure eventually I will either try it or not. Those would be the two possibilities. I also got feedback from Greg Thompson, I think is his name, and this is a really cool one. This is a neat little hack, I guess. And I think it's going to lead me into a few other Bash RC tips. So we'll start with this one, because it's really cool, and it's really easy to set up. So he just sent me a link to jrenard.info/blog/abettercpwithpv.html. And this is a great little trick that you can put into your Bash RC or your ZSH RC file. And what it does is it uses this program called PV, that's Papa Victor, and you have to install it, probably. I don't know that it's going to be on your distribution. It certainly wasn't, I don't think, on mine. So if you do an install of PV, Papa Victor, PV is described by its own man page as a program to monitor the progress of data through a pipe, meaning that PV allows a user to see the progress of data through a pipeline by giving information such as time elapsed, percentage completed, current throughput rate, total data transferred, and ETA. So there you go, PV. So it's kind of a pipeable function, and what you can do with it is create your own version of copy that uses, you know, that copies through PV, so that you get feedback on the status of your copy. Now, obviously, if you're copying a file from, you know, a little text file from one place to another, and it takes all of a blink of an eye, it's not that big of a deal. But I'm sure we've all copied an ISO image or a big folder full of photos to a backup drive or whatever. We're talking like 700 megabytes or a gigabyte. And it's just, you know, you do the copy command and then you get silence, which is good because you don't want a bunch of noise. Possibly you do, but you often do not. That's the principle of making everything scriptable, etc. But maybe you do want that sometimes on your local machine. So you can run copy through PV, and the way to do that is to create a function for Bash. Because I think I think it was just last episode, 720, the 20th episode of the 7th season, that I was talking about Bash and kind of my realization that it was a very real programming language. And a couple of people commented on that and said, yes, you are absolutely right, it is. Although there are obviously better tools for certain jobs than Bash, but, I mean, for other jobs, Bash is exactly what you'd want to use, such as something like this, copying through a pipe. So you can create your own function, which I never really understood what a function was, and I still am not sure if I understand what a class versus a function is. You know, it feels like they're almost the same kind of thing. So without going into what that difference is, since it doesn't matter, you can create functions in Bash. And functions, if you think of it, almost like a mini script, you know? Function is like this thing that you can keep calling upon, and it will run a bunch of... it will do something for you each and every time. It's... how is it different than an application? I don't know. I guess it isn't, really. But it is a self-contained little bundle of code that you can call upon at any time after you've created it to do a certain set of things. That's a really technical definition. Function. So you can put this in your .bashrc file, or again, like in your ZSH file, whatever you're using works just fine. And all you do is type function space PVCP, so that's Papa Victor CP, like copy. So you're making sort of a version of copy for yourself. PVCP and then two empty parentheses, meaning that this function doesn't take any arguments itself. You open up a curly brace, and you establish a variable. Source equals $1. So the $1, of course, if you've done any Bash scripting at all, you know that it is the first thing after the command. It's the first argument after the command. So if you do pvcp GNU World Order outline.txt, then that wouldn't be a complete command. But that would, the GNU World Order outline.txt would be the $1. It's the first argument right after the pvcp command. So we've made it a variable, we've called it source, and we've given it, we've established that it is equal to whatever's in the first argument spot. And you kind of do some if looping so that you can see if the second command, so that would be $2, right? So you can do if bracket dash d $2, close bracket. That says, if the second argument is a directory, then destination equals $2 slash $ parentheses base name space $ source close parentheses. So all he's doing here is hacking on to make sure that if the second argument is a directory, then the source entity that you've issued your little command through to copy, that it goes into the destination, not, you know, there's not some kind of error that's going to say I can't replace the directory with a file or anything like that. It's just gonna, it's making a little bit of a correction for your command. Else destination equals $2. So we've just established a variable. And now we've got two variables. We've got source being the first argument and destination being the second argument. And then you close your little if loop with an fi. That's if spelled backwards. And then the only other thing that you have to do is issue the pv command, which is pv space $ parentheses $ curly bracket source close curly bracket space pipe space greater than symbol or redirect whatever space $ curly bracket destination curly bracket, and then you close this whole function with another curly bracket. So what we've done is we have created variables based on what kind of copy command you would normally do, and then we do a PV of those variables so that we're doing a PV of the source and redirecting it into the destination. Now if you in Bash or ZSH, whatever, source your Bash RC file to bring that function into your environment, and then issue the command pvcp space some big file .mp4 space some new location of the big file .mp4. And that's it. You've copied it, and you'll see it progress with a little status bar. It's really pretty neat. And it's also really nice to have some custom functions in your BashRC. And I will post a link to that blog post in the show notes so that you can just copy and paste the code directly into your BashRC. I've been trying to stress test it a little bit, but honestly, I kind of forget to use it. I guess having the status is nice, but it's not a must-have, because I just flat-out forget to use it instead of CP, and I'm not quite ready to alias CP to PVCP. Don't think I'll ever do that. So anyway, I wanted to talk a little bit about the couple of functions in my terminal, in my BashRC file, and feel free to let me know of any interesting ones that you've got. None of these are custom. I've stolen them from online, from the internet, from probably just other BashRCs that are included by default in other distributions. But they're all somewhat interesting. There aren't that many. There are two that I can find without really looking through all my computers. So for my main workstation, I have one for making a directory and then CDing directly into it. That's been kind of nice. So I call that MC, which I'm sure for some people would totally conflict with Midnight Commander, but it doesn't for me, because I don't use Midnight Commander. So function MC, paren paren, open curly brace, this is a short one, make dir space dash p space quote $*** close quote, space and, space, cd, space, quote, $*, close $*, space, ampersand, pwd. Now the pwd I run because I sometimes forget that I've just used mc, and then I try to cd into the thing again out of habit, which is kind of silly. So PWD is just kind of feedback for me that, hey, you've just gone into this directory that you created. So it's confirmation, I guess. Not necessary. And then close your curly bracket. And then sure enough, if you do MC, I don't know, test dir return, then test dir is created and you're CD'd into it, and you get confirmation of that right there on the command line. So that's a nice little function. I mean, it's a one-liner. It's kind of silly, I guess, to do it. But if you're frequently making directories and then CDing into them to start building some kind of file structure, then it really is kind of handy to have. So that's one. The other one that I don't honestly use this much, but for a while I was using it, and it kind of combines the CD and the ls-l, the series of commands. Because, I mean, let's face it, we're always CDing into a folder, and then we do an ls, right, to see. I think you almost do that more when you're a complete noob, because you're not too sure. You're not familiar with tabbed completion yet. You're not really that confident that CD command actually worked how you expected it. And kind of the way that you get a feel for your file system is right after you CD into a directory, you ls. So, I mean, that's almost, for a very long while, that was built into my, it was just that simple. I would CD into a directory and then ls. Even when I didn't need to ls, I would do that. So, this command makes those two things happen all at once. And it is, I had made it LC or CL. I actually made it both ways because I couldn't remember which way I had it, so I had to alias it for both. But the function, let's just call it CL, because you're CDing and then listing. So it would be function CL paren paren, open curly bracket, if bracket $$pound equals zero, close bracket, semicolon, then CD space and space LL. Now, if you don't have LL aliased as LS-L, then you might need to do that, or you could just explicitly say CD and LS-L. On my system, LL is aliased to ls-l, so I'm just calling my own alias in my function. It's getting pretty hairy. Else cd space quote $asterisk close quote space and ll, and then you close that if loop fi, and you close the function curly bracket. Now what's going on there is in the first if possibility, if in the first then, not the else. So when you say if bracket $pound equals zero, you're saying if the number of arguments following my initial command is zero, then cd and then list. So we all know what happens if you just type in cd, right? You get taken home. Actually, I think there's a technicality there, which CLI Magic or Delta Ray was talking about in his Bash talk at Southeast Linux Fest this past Southeast Linux Fest. I don't remember what the subtlety was there, but let's just say, without any subtlety, if you type in cd into a Bash prompt, you get taken home, and that would be the expected behavior then if you start using CL, right? If you type in just CL, your expectation then would be to be taken home and then to have home listed for you. So that's allowing for this. If there's no arguments after CD, if after the initial command of CL, then simply issue CD and then list in the list mode the contents of that directory. Else, now we're assuming that there is an argument after CL. We're not checking for it, we're assuming, because if it's not empty, then it must have something there. So cd, quote, to avoid space problems, $asterisk, close quote, and then list in a list form all the files in whatever directory we just got taken to. So why we're using an asterisk there is it just says to, you know, $asterisk says to use all of the arguments. Just look at it as if though it was a single string and use that as the argument. Meaning that if I said cd, or rather cl space foo space bar, it would not try to cd into foo and then into bar or anything like that, which I don't even know why it would, but that's not what it would do, obviously. It would just be a cd into foo space bar. It sees that as one single argument because of the $asterisk, rather than, for instance, saying cd into $1, which would just, it would look at foo and foo alone, and it would cd into foo. So this is saying take all of your arguments, put them in quotations, and then cd into them, and then list verbosely all of the contents of that directory. So that's a handy one. And again, I think it's handier for new users whose workflow tends, or at least in my mind, I could totally be wrong, and I'm not trying to insult anyone who does this, but I, at least for me, it was when I was a new user, I would cd and ls as a matter of habit. It was just something that you did to maneuver through your file system and kind of keep track of exactly where you were, because it was such a new thing. And now that I'm a little bit more familiar with that, I can cd into a directory and I don't need to do a list. I don't need to know what is in the directory if I already know what is in the directory. I have faith that I'm in that directory, and then I can open up Emacs at a certain file, or I can do whatever I want to on a certain file using tabbed completion. Whatever I'm doing, it's a different workflow for me. So that I don't use that all that often, but it is there. It's a function. It exists in my Bash RC. So if you have any really cool Bash functions in your Bash RC, let me know so that I can steal them and also share them with the other listeners. Oh, it's time for a coffee break. Yes, it is definitely time for coffee. So if you're not drinking coffee right now, take a moment and ask yourself, why not? And then go get yourself a cup of coffee and then come back and we'll continue the show. Thank you. welcome back. I hope you've got a good cup of coffee there. I know that I'm about to start experiencing a lot of great coffee because there's a great new cafe just downstairs from my office, and it's really difficult to resist the urge to get one of their really, really excellent lattes, like, every day, once a day. I mean, I have a coffee maker in my office, so a French press, actually, so I really, the cheaper option is to not go downstairs and get a latte, but, you know, it is a difficult thing to resist. And speaking of that, I actually did pose, I think, maybe it was, I guess it must have been last episode, I asked what everyone was using for coffee these days, like to brew coffee, and I got a couple of responses, actually. Jonathan Rogers, I think it was, says that he has been using almost exclusively an espresso machine, which sounds like the right way to make coffee to me, or a French press, which also is, I think, a very good way of using, of making coffee. My good friend Harley, Inbody, believe it or not, that's his name, Harley, he uses a French press as well, and I thought I had another response about that, but I'm not finding it now, which is too bad. It might have been over IRC, and certainly that would have been forgotten by now, but yeah, there are, I mean, I don't think I really heard anyone. Maybe I did, actually. I think one person might have said they were using a drip pot or whatever. A drip, you know, like a normal coffee maker, whatever those things are called. And I have to say, I mean, first of all, let's get it clear that there's almost no wrong way to make coffee. I mean, I don't care what you're doing. It's going to be pretty good. You know, I mean, even the drip pot thing works well enough. I mean, granted, I find that if you've got a not very strong flavored coffee and you're using drip with those little filters, those paper filters, sometimes you get weird paper flavor from those filters. But then again, you know, in a very sort of tolerant world view, you could say that paper flavor is part of the experience. And it is, you know, I mean, think of it. You go to like an all-night diner, you know, one of those suspicious-looking diners where it's all night and truck drivers are there, and it's just really kind of a diner. So you go in, all-American diner, that's what I'm trying to say. So you go in and you're like, give me a cup of Joe, and they give you a cup of Joe, and it's a cup of Joe. You know, it's got that flavor. It's cheap coffee, tastes like the paper filter. Possibly the paper filter has been used twice. You know, it's just that kind of coffee. There's some sense of beauty in that. But at the same time, it's not something I would want to drink every day. So, that said, I have been finding lately that the French press method is really just kind of my favorite. And it's not something philosophical. It's not something that I've really... I didn't really mean to really, really like French press. It's just that really has been... I mean, it helps that that's what I have in my office, so it's kind of like one of those things that I've been using a lot lately. But there's a drip machine outside of my office that I could use to make coffee. I choose not to. The French press just has that sort of... I mean, it's just the water and the coffee grounds, right? I mean, that's all it is. It's just that pure sort of reaction between those two substances. It's the infusion of those bean particles into the water, and it's a beautifully pure kind of flavor. And it's a little bit more robust. Some people who try it will taste it, and it tastes almost abrasive or maybe stronger than what they're used to. But I tend to like it. So I think the French press is kind of the way to go for me, but like I say, I mean, heck, coffee is coffee. What can you do? And anyway, that's not even what I was going to talk about. I meant to talk about setting up Fedora specifically, and I'll tell you why in a moment, for what I'll just call public use, or I could call, I guess, serious use. And what I mean by that is, or why I say that specifically, is because I've recently been re-imaging all of the computers at the school, the multimedia school where I work. And, well, I shouldn't say school, because it's not just a school. It's also a member-supported, basically independent studio, essentially, because there's a lot of production that goes on here. So I've been re-imaging all of these computers with some new software that I have not mentioned the name of this company all throughout Season 7 successfully, and I'm not going to start mentioning them now. So it's not Linux, though. But since I was re-imaging all of these computers, I figured, well, I might as well partition the drives and reserve about 15 gigs. You know, 15 gigs. Who's going to miss it, right? I'll partition the drives, reserve about 15 gigs for a Linux install. And then any of the workshops or classes that I give or that I teach, I can have students boot into that Linux partition. Oh, did I mention I was going to put Linux onto it? If not, yeah. So 15 gigs, put Linux onto the 15 gigs, and then for any workshop or class that I do, I can have people boot into the Linux partition. So I was thinking about doing Slackware. I mean, why wouldn't I? Slackware is the distribution that I use. It's the one that I kind of trust and know, and it seemed like a logical choice. But I thought, well, Fedora has that fancy new GNOME 3 thing, and these people really, really, like the people I've shown GNOME 3 to, like the normal people, really, really seem to like it a lot. And the sensibility at this particular place is very oriented toward kind of the slick and the fancy and the eye candy. And while KDE does have all that stuff going on, there's something, I think, more familiar to people, to GNOME 3, people here, to GNOME 3, than a desktop like KDE, which is, I mean, it's a lot more complex, right? And when they weren't complex, they got a lot of flack for it, you know, back at the 4.0, 4.1 days. So, yeah, it's a complex desktop, and I thought, well, I could scale it back, I could hide some of the complexity, and I think I'm gonna try GNOME 3 for these people. And so that's what I did. Fedora, GNOME 3, on a 15 gig hidden, well, hidden, just a partition that people aren't going to see unless I specifically tell them how to reboot these computers into this hidden partition. Or this other partition. I keep saying hidden because to them it is hidden. To you and me, it's not hidden at all. It's just a partition. But to people who don't understand what partitions are, it's hidden. So I installed Fedora 17 on a whole, about 17 computers one weekend, and have installed it on about 34 more, maybe? No, 35, 36, 37. About 40 others. So that's like 57 computers with these little 15 gig partitions with Fedora on it. And I kind of left that as is. I mean, I just figured it was better to have a partition of Linux on every computer that I ever have to deal with than not. And I think that's a pretty good rule of thumb. So, and 15 gigs, no one's going to miss it. Not with hard drive sizes being what they are now. So I installed Fedora, and naturally I did it with by a Kickstart file. And it was to my great pleasure that I discovered how easy it was to create a Kickstart file. Now, I've created a Kickstart file before, but it was just an academic exercise. I didn't actually have a purpose for it. But this time I really needed the Kickstart file because it was serious now. I was really installing this thing. And I don't know that I ever remember this. I might have. I don't really remember. I know that there's a Fedora wiki page on Kickstart files. And if you go to that page, the guy has a sample Kickstart. And that's what I used initially for my little academic exercise about a year ago or more, maybe, on discovering what this Kickstart thing is. But on Fedora, at least now, maybe then as well, and I just didn't know it, but now, after you do an initial install of Fedora on a computer, it actually generates a Kickstar file for you and dumps it into your root user's home directory, or the root partition, something like that. I don't remember where. It dumps the thing into your on your hard drive, and you can then take it and modify it and actually develop a really nice Kickstart file, which I still kind of want to do. I was just doing this, and I knew that these partitions were not going to be used very often, so I thought, well, I will do the basics. You know, I will construct a Kickstart file that gets me close enough to where I think I want to be, and I'm not going to spend too much time on it. So it could be even better. But the Kickstart file contains all of the essential kind of configuration stuff. You know, the initial user, the host name, domain name, time zone, things like that. You know, so it makes for a very quick install. And I could have developed it a lot more and had lots of cool automatic installs occur. And so that was very exciting and very easy. Now, the thing to keep in mind is that this is Fedora. And believe me, I thought about this. I thought, do I really want to go with something that is known for being cutting edge and wild and crazy and updates every other day? And I thought, well, probably not. Not on anything that I ever expect to be anything like a production machine. And it turns out I was exactly correct, because after the first install of the first, like, three computers, I must have let one of them update, or maybe I updated manually, I don't really remember, but the very next, you know, I reboot the thing, and I go back to it later, turn it back on, or I shut it down, go back to it later, turn it back on, and the thing will not boot. Hangs at boot. Can't figure out what's going on. Turns out, of course, that the kernel has been updated out from under me, and it will no longer boot correctly. So I thought that's a great example of why Fedora as a distribution just, it's not something that you can hand someone and say, here you go, here's a distribution that you can use and call it your own, and you're done, you're switched to Linux now. It's just not true. The thing you have to do on Fedora is go into the settings, the update settings, and turn it off. Tell it not to update itself automatically. I do the security updates automatically, but all the other updates and the checking for updates, I simply do not allow it to happen. And then I manually go through and either okay or not okay any kinds of updates whenever I feel like it. This seems like a hassle on one hand. You know, it almost seems like, why would they make me do this? Why wouldn't their default be don't check for updates and don't automatically install any of those updates anyway? And I guess it's a philosophical thing. You know, some people think, well, an operating system should check for updates and it should update stuff automatically. And that's just kind of the theory behind being quote-unquote user-friendly. And I can understand that. The nice thing about Linux and Fedora Linux inclusively is that you, the administrator, are able to go in and turn that stuff off very, very easily, actually. And that's a powerful, powerful thing that you shouldn't underestimate, because there are other operating systems out there, one of which I have to deal with, that just don't really let you do that. They don't give you that level of control. So your users are constantly being bombarded by offers of updates and whether they want to update or not. And even if they say that they do want to update, they don't have permission to update, so it becomes like this stupid loop of, but I thought you said you wanted to update. Well, I do. Well, sorry, you don't have permission. Then why did you ask me? You know, and it's just a consistent thing that gets really, really annoying and kind of embarrassing on a couple of levels. So, very nice to have that configuration option on Fedora, but it's one of those things that if you're going to deploy Fedora on a massive scale, or any scale, any new Linux user scale, or even yourself, but you need it for real work, that you want to get stuff done on this computer, then you need to turn those updates off. And it's easy to get there. It's a simple matter of going into your activities overview and typing in update, and there's a setting, an application for settings for the updates and where they come from and how often they are checked for and whether they get auto-installed or not. And the thing that I would advise you to do is to turn it off and to give yourself a little bit of a stable system from the beginning, and do not update too frequently if you want it to remain stable, because Fedora, just that's what they do. They update things, they try new stuff out, and they kind of assume that, the assumption seems to be made that you are the beta tester, and that's just not necessarily the case. You know, I mean, I think a lot of Fedora users are people who just happen to want the Red Hat-ish environment, but they want something a little bit more, I wouldn't say robust, but something more repositories than what Red Hat or even the knockoffs like CentOS or Scientific Linux offer. And I've done an episode on kind of Red Hat, and I think it was Scientific Linux, and kind of running it as your distribution, and I've really found that it's not something that you really want to do. First of all, they don't have GNOME 3 yet. That would be one reason. And that means you would have to either run GNOME 2 or just come up with some other desktop, which you can do. But if you want GNOME 3, it's kind of Fedora or nothing. But then secondly, it's just, you know, it's so easy on Fedora to install RPM, Fusion, and everything you ever want is at your fingertips. You know, it's kind of Debian that way. You just apt-get or yum install, and it's just done for you. It's there's no question. There's no search. You know, you don't bother searching for the thing. You just install it because you know it's there. So it's practically like that. And on the Red Hat stuff and the Red Hat clone stuff, you don't get that experience. In my experience, you don't get that kind of everything's out there available for you, because they tend to be a lot more conservative. So with Fedora, you can have both if you work it out that way. You can have the Red Hat environment, but you can also have every application you could ever want at your fingertips. And finally, you can also have the stability that you would expect from a more stable distribution. But you have to give it to yourself. That's not how it comes out of a box. So just keep that in mind if you're ever handing out Linux distributions to people or trying to get people into Linux. You want to, if you're doing the Red Hat thing, and there's not really a good reason not to, I mean, it's a great distribution, I love it, I keep using it on secondary boxes, but you do want to kind of mitigate those updates, or else it will end badly. I think it'd be a pity to end this episode without any mention of Slackware, because I'll be honest, I was actually thinking, you know, kind of in my dreams of how I would come back and with my triumphant return to season 8, I kind of thought it'd be cool to start the show back up concurrent with the release of Slackware 14, because that is looming on the horizon. But then two things happened, and one being that Slackware 14 isn't released yet, so I'd have to just keep waiting. Number two is I realized that even after Slackware 14 was released, it wouldn't be something that I would actually have on my computer and any real experience with for a little while, because I am subscribed to purchase the DVDs, so they just send me the DVDs whenever they release a new version. But it usually, there's a lag. You know, the internet gets Slackware released before I do, because I have to wait for the DVDs to be pressed and printed or whatever and mailed out. So I'll be delayed in getting Slackware 14 on my computers anyway, and I'm not really in that big of a rush to update. Honestly, I mean, I was kind of thinking about it the other day. The big deal for me about Slackware 14 is GIMP 2.8 and I guess Emacs 24, and even that isn't really that big of a deal. It's really just GIMP. That's like the big exciting new feature for me, because I've been using 2.8 on Fedora for a little while. I haven't really been doing that much graphic work lately, so even that usage has been pretty light, but it doesn't take long to use 2.8, and you get really, really addicted to its features really, really fast. It was just a leap and bound ahead, and that's good. That's always a good thing. And the single user, or the single window interface, beautiful, beautiful, wonderful thing. Best thing. Couldn't have happened to a nicer program. So anyway, Slackware 14 is on the horizon. It's out there. We're waiting for it. As of right now, like this moment, it's on release candidate 4. And they were kind of, I guess you're always kind of thinking that your release candidate is going to be the one. I was going to say, they were kind of hoping that 3 would be the one, but then there were some patches that had to be done to, like, glibc and stuff like that. Anytime I see that in a listing, I assume it's a big, important thing that I'd never understand. Quite possibly it is. I don't know. Lots of patches happening, and so they bumped the version up to release candidate 4, and so as of, well, that was on the 30th of August. The 31st, they updated Emacs 24. And now we're just kind of waiting. We're waiting for bugs to show up, I guess. So, could be a little while. On kind of related news, I guess, is Slackware Media, the book of Slackware Media, which is a really good book. And I had some copies that I was selling at Southeast Linux Fest. 330 was helping me out with that. He did a great job of selling my books a lot better than I ever did. And it was neat. It was cool because, I mean, it really is a good book. I feel pretty good about it. I feel really good about it, actually. I feel fine. And I recently, or a couple of months ago now, but I went through a bunch of revisions to make it a lot more Slackware version generic, meaning that there are no references in there as to whether you're running 13, 13.37, 14. Doesn't really care, because if you're reading the book for the content, then it doesn't really matter what versions of software we're talking about. It's all basically the same. So that happily has been kind of removed from needing to follow Slackware around. Not that Slackware is a big moving target, but I just figured if you're going to go to print, like paper print, you should probably be in it for the long haul. So Slackware Media was sort of ready, but then I was going through this process with this little print company of getting it onto like Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com and any other bookstore that would be crazy enough to carry it on site. I mean, a brick and mortar store could technically have it. I don't see why they would, but they could. And turns out that I had like the title page in the wrong place. Apparently the publishing industry is really, really picky about things like that. Like, you can't have the title page with your ISBN number, you know, facing the wrong direction, or they will totally reject it or whatever. So made some last minute touch-ups very recently, resubmitted it for approval or whatever, and the point of all this is that eventually you'll be able to go to like Amazon or Barnes & Noble and purchase a paperback version of Slackware Media. As I've said before, you can also just go to the website and download it for free. I believe, as I've said before, it doesn't matter to me because I don't make any money off of the paperback. It's just something that I think would be kind of neat, you know, for myself to have. And if you want a hard copy, then you are now able to do that. Although when I say now, I mean soon, because I'm still waiting for it to show up and get approved and everything. So I think I did mention this before, but I lied. I was premature then, and it's still a little bit premature right now. You still can't actually go out there and get it, but it will be out there eventually. So both Slackware and Slackware Media are looming on the horizon again. Although, I mean, again, Slackware Media, you can always just go to the site and look at it. It's all there. So in that sense, it is right there. But if you want the hard copy, that's looming on the horizon. Slackware is looming on the horizon. And it's very exciting because it should be very, very good. It will have newer versions of KDE and GIMP, and I imagine a lot of other stuff. But those are two things that I'm particularly interested in. That is about it. I think that's all I have to say for this episode. So thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. This has been GNU World Order Season 8, Episode The Zeroth. You can reach me online at GNUWorldOrder.info or by email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can reach me on Jabber at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can see me on IRC. Talk to me. IRC, we use the Freenode network. You can go to the Ogcast Planet channel and find me there as Nagatatu. So thank you very much for listening, and I will talk to you next time.
Coming up.